have social services, you have shelters for different people.
Mm-hmm.
If I may be born in a family that doesn't look after me, there are ways for me to find a path out of it. Yes, maybe not in the initial years of my life, mm-hmm. but as we grow up, we can separate ourselves from these dangerous values that may come from our environment.
So you mean that our choices comes after the things that have been decided for us? The thing that is important is the things that we are going to choose in future.
Well, initially in the first 5-7 years of our lives, mm-hmm. we don't know the difference between right and wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? But after the age of 7, the consciousness starts to come in. The ability to differentiate between right and wrong comes in, and it is part of our fitrah as well. That might be at a lower level for a very young child, but as we grow up, the innate nature does start to strengthen because we start to get acquainted with the world around us.
Exactly.
If you look at something as simple as alcohol, right? We are talking about, if we go back to someone choosing a friend who's into drugs and alcohol. Even those who drink alcohol are very well aware that it is harmful for them. They still do it out of choice. And in the many documentaries, if you go to see that, look into these issues.
But you know, the place they are living in and the people that they have been growing with sort of push them into that direction.
We have many examples in the world that goes against this. You have many people who come from very bad neighborhoods who grew up to be perfectly good mm-hmm. people. They did not let the environment pull them down.
Yes.
There's a difference between allowing ourselves to go ahead with that environment or pulling ourselves out of that situation.
Yes.
Yes, it is harder than it would be for me and you who have grown up in, alhamdulillah, very pious families.
Yes, good situation.
But that doesn't mean that it's impossible. We can't mm-hmm. say it's impossible. It might be harder, but that does not mean they can't get themselves out of it.
Yes, and it's not impossible, but it's harder.
Yes, I'm not going to pull them down because they have got into that situation, perhaps because they got the wrong upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I stand by my point that they can get themselves out of that situation with the help that you get in the world. There's a lot of information that goes around today, and
mm-hmm.
the very few people who can say that today they don't have access to the internet or they don't have access to services around the world that help people pull themselves out of disadvantaged situations.
So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
How is it fair that a person living in a bad country that is surrounded with too much of war and bad events, how shall we call it fair that a person who is living in a bad situation is going to be judged the same way as the other person who's been living in a country that is fulfilling and everything is very peachy and pinky?
Well, the short answer is they're not going to be judged in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Allah is the most just. As well as that, he's the most merciful. What Allah is going to do is judge everyone as per the situation that they were in, right?
Thing that I want to hear.
There might be one person like us who were born into a Muslim family. We mm-hmm. were born into a household that had the Quran on the shelf, right? And we always had some sort of semblance to Islam throughout our family. Allah is going to ask us on Judgment Day, what did you do with what I gave you? I gave you the Quran. I gave you the pristine examples of mm-hmm. the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. What did you do with that? Right? And there might be one Tom who just lives his life like that and then he commits suicide at the end of it. That's the end of his life. There might be another Tom who realizes that this is wrong. He doesn't necessarily come towards Islam itself. He doesn't find Islam itself. But what he does is he sees that, yes, my environment is bad. He escapes from that kind of climate and he dedicates his life to helping youths out there who are going through a similar situation.
Yes, that is very true.
The struggle that Tom goes through,
mm-hmm.
right? That struggle that he had to go through to improve the conditions of his life,
yes.
to reach some sort of understanding, even if it's the Christian understanding of what mm-hmm. God is, to
just
bring iman upon that, right? That struggle is what Allah is going to reward him with. We should not be surprised on the Day of Judgment if that Tom has a higher status than many of us born into Muslim households.
Yes, yes.
Right? Because our struggle with what we were given was far less compared to the struggle of Tom.
Exactly. Now, we are giving a specific situation, and God is the fairest of all. He's going to judge us based on whatever he has given us. And also, as the sister mentioned, we have a free will of choosing the other people that are going to come into our lives. So this was the whole time that we had for today's episode. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, it's horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you've just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighboring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Jamhuri Islami Iran
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kiev fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify, week by week, the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kiev in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power. Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together. And probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
The
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women, in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity of the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories, and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could, at the end of the day, set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made-in-Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallophabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces. The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S. left the accord in 2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses had been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten. About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years, a system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments.
Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and two of his children had sought to block New York Attorney General Letitia James from interviewing them under oath. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protest, and William Rashbaum. The piece is titled New York Attorney General Can Question Trump and Two Children, Judge Rules. Stay with us for more. The New York Attorney General can question Donald J. Trump and two of his adult children under oath as part of a civil inquiry into his business practices. A judge ruled on Thursday, 17th of February, the latest in a string of legal defeats Donald Trump has suffered since leaving office. The ruling came just 3 days after a court filing by the Attorney General Letitia James in the same matter revealed that Mr. Trump's long-time accounting firm had cut ties with him and had essentially retracted a decade's worth of his financial statements. Letitia James's inquiry and a parallel criminal investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney are both examining whether Donald Trump used those statements to improperly inflate the value of his assets so he could receive favorable loans. Lawyers for the Trump family had sought to prohibit Letitia James, a Democrat, from interviewing Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump. They had argued that Ms. James was politically biased against Donald Trump and was inappropriately using her civil inquiry to aid the district attorney's criminal investigation, which she's also participating in. But in a written ruling, the judge, Arthur Engoron, dismissed that point, saying it completely misses the mark. After dismantling several other arguments, he concluded that Ms. James had uncovered copious evidence of possible financial fraud, evidence that entitled her to question the Trump family. She has the clear right to do so, the judge wrote, ordering that Mr. Trump and his son and daughter face questioning in the next 3 weeks. Thursday's ruling was the latest in a notable legal losing streak for Donald Trump, which has included several rebukes from the United States Supreme Court. Since he left office, Mr. Trump has lost the battle to withhold his financial records from the Manhattan District Attorney, to block a congressional committee from inspecting his White House records as part of an investigation into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol, and to appeal the results of the 2020 presidential election. For Mr. Trump, the fallout from some of these decisions could be significant, exposing him to civil and criminal liability, as he has come under investigation from at least three prosecutors, in addition to Letitia James. Not only are the authorities in New York scrutinizing Mr. Trump, the district attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, has convened a grand jury as part of an investigation into the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. Today, justice prevailed, Letitia James said in a statement, adding, "No one is above the law." In a rambling statement released on Thursday evening, 17th of February, Donald Trump blasted the decision and attacked Letitia James, Hillary Clinton, and the media. "It is a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in history," he said, adding, "I can't get a fair hearing in New York because of the hatred of me by judges and the judiciary." He has previously denied all wrongdoing. "The entire system is corrupt," a spokeswoman for the Trump Organization said. The ruling does not mean that Letitia James will automatically receive the answers that she is seeking. Donald Trump and his children can invoke their constitutional right not to incriminate themselves, as Mr. Trump's other adult son, Eric Trump, did when questioned by the Attorney General's office back in October of 2020. The Trump family also intends to appeal the decision, according to the spokeswoman. The judge's decision followed a fiery virtual hearing in state Supreme Court in Manhattan on Thursday, during which lawyers for Mr. Trump and the Attorney General made their cases. Several times, Mr. Trump's lawyers became so heated that Justice Engoron and his law clerk had to call for a timeout, raising their hands in the shape of a T, a gesture more often seen at a sporting event than in a courtroom. Although Letitia James signaled in court papers that she had amassed significant evidence against Donald Trump's family business, she has accused the Trump Organization of engaging in fraudulent or misleading practices. She has said that she needs to question Donald Trump and his children before determining her next move. Mr. Trump and his children sought to block the questioning, and Letitia James responded in a court filing last month, arguing that there was heightened need for testimony from the three family members. She said that by questioning them, she would be able to determine who was responsible for the misstatements and omissions that the company made in its financial documents. Because Letitia James's inquiry is civil, she cannot bring criminal charges. If she finds evidence of wrongdoing, she can file a lawsuit against Mr. Trump, his company, or others involved in the business. In last month's filing, Letitia James said that her lawyers had not yet reached a final decision on a lawsuit, but argued that the grounds for conducting the investigation are beyond reproach. On Monday, 14th of February, Letitia James released a letter in which Mr. Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, declared that Mr. Trump's financial statements from 2011 to 2020 were not reliable. Mr. Trump provided those financial statements, which include various disclaimers noting that they are unaudited, to his lenders and at least to one insurance company. They are central to both the civil and criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. Mazars USA said in a letter that it had not, as a whole, found material discrepancies between the information the Trump Organization provided and the actual value of Mr. Trump's assets, something that Mr. Trump's lawyers asserted had effectively rendered the civil and criminal investigations moot. But Justice Engoron scoffed at the argument, likening it to the dystopian slogans like "War is Peace" in George Orwell's 1984, to Lewis Carroll's inverse meanings in Through the Looking Glass, and to the former senior Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway's Alternative Facts. Suggesting that the Mazars red flag warning about the financial statements made the investigations moot, the judge wrote, is as audacious as it is preposterous. The criminal investigation, which is similarly focused on whether Donald Trump used those statements to mislead his lenders about the value of his hotels, golf clubs and other properties, is being led by Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan district attorney who inherited it when he took office in January. Last year, under Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance Jr., Manhattan prosecutors separately indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing them of conducting a years-long scheme to evade taxes by compensating employees with special off-the-books benefits such as apartment rentals and luxury cars. Mr. Trump's lawyer said that the criminal inquiry, which also involves investigators from Letitia James's office, would improperly benefit if the Attorney General's office questioned Mr. Trump and his children in the civil inquiry. They argued that Letitia James would be able to obtain information that would be valuable to the criminal investigation without having to provide the family members the immunity that they would receive were they to testify in front of a criminal grand jury. Under New York law, witnesses who appear before the grand jury receive immunity from prosecution on the subject of their testimony. After maintaining a neutral posture during the hearing, Justice Engoron was blunt in his ruling, which also directed the former president to provide the Attorney General with documents she sought in her subpoena. Addressing the argument that Letitia James was improperly using the civil investigation to bolster the criminal inquiry, he noted that the Trumps had not been asked to appear before a grand jury. He was also unconvinced by the argument that Letitia James was politically biased, which Mr. Trump's lawyers advanced by citing statements that the Attorney General had made while campaigning, including her promise to use every area of the law to investigate Mr. Trump, who was then still in office. Justice Engoron said that Letitia James had the right to say whatever she liked about Mr. Trump while running for office, and that there was a clear basis for her investigation.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim philosophers, thinkers, jurists, and scholars all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the life account of an outstanding Shiite marja who is living in the city of Qom. We can say he's no one but Sayyid Musa Shobairi Zanjani, a Shiite authority and a teacher of advanced courses of fiqh and usul al-fiqh in the city of Qom. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Sayyid Musa Shobairi Zanjani, his life account, and he belongs to a scholarly family. His father was also a marja, and a scholar. Let's talk a little bit about the life account and the biography of Sayyid Musa Shubairi Zanjani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Sayyid Musa Shubairi Zanjani, born in 1306 according to solar calendar, as you mentioned, to a religious family. His father, late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Zanjani, the one who is leading the Salat in Holy Shrine of Hazrat Ma'asuma, and it's interesting that even nowadays the people of Qom are blessed by the leadership of the Salat, I mean Jama'a Salat, yes, in Holy Shrine of Hazrat Ma'asuma. May Allah prolong his life, sure, inshallah, to be blessed by his presence in the Holy Shrine. He started his study from his childhood under the custody of his father. And when he finished the elementary level of Hausa within 4 or 5 years, that was a kind of surprise period of time to finish off the first 10 years. Typically, students of seminary Hausa undertake this period of time through 10 years. But as it is narrated in his biography, he finished that period of time within 3 or 4 years. And because of his talent, he benefited from the outstanding ulama of the seminary of Qom. Mm-hmm. Namely is Ayatollah Sayyid Hussein Burujerdi, who was the main outstanding marja before the revolution of Islamic Republic of Iran. Sayyid Abul Qasim Khoi, he actually had this chance to go to Najaf, stay there, and benefit from the circles of study of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Qasim Al-Khoi. And also another marajah that it is named in his biography. He is known as being expert in the knowledge of Rijal, besides being a marja who is supposed to know fiqh, I mean jurisprudence, fiqh usul as a legal theory of Islam.
Yes.
These two main a topic that all maraji, they are expert, yes, in. Besides being expert in these two fields of study, he's also known of being expert in Ilmur Rijal, which might be translated as the life account of the transmitters of the ahadith, mm-hmm, in order to authenticate the ahadith through the chain of the narrators.
That's right.
So that is a very important topic to be studied. And so
Rajal
here
refers to Rajul, which,
yes,
are the men of narration.
Form. Yes,
the men of narrations, isn't it?
The men, yes, of the power form of the,
okay,
man. Yeah.
That's right, okay?
Yeah.
That's all right. Thank you, Sheikh Mahdavi. Sheikh Ziyania, what about his works? And he has also established some centers and institutes regarding the Hausa studies. What are they and what are his most outstanding publications?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, let me mention the books and the works that Ayatollah Shubairi Zanjani has authored. The most important one are those ones that are related to Ilm al-Rijal. For example, Ayatollah Shubairi Zanjani has a commentary on the four main books of Shia that are Usulul Arba'ah, I mean Kitabul Kafi, mm-hmm, At-Tahdhib, Al-Istibsar, wa Kitab Man La Yahdhurhu Al-Faqih. That these four books, they all are hadithi books. And because this scholar is a very prominent scholar regarding the knowledge and the scholarly studies about hadith, that's why he has authored a commentary, very of good, course, individual commentary for each of these four books.
Mm-hmm.
Beside this, he has ta'liqe or sharh on Ilm al-Rijal from Najashi and also on the Rijal book of Shaykh al-Tusi, rahmatullah alayhi. And I should mention this, that without any exaggeration, we should express that the generation that in Qom are prominent in the field of Rijal are the students of Ayatollah Shubairi Zanjani. He has delivered a group of students that these people, these students are now really prominent in Ilm al-Rijal.
Very good.
And all these figures are indebted by the knowledge of Ayatollah Shubayri Zanjani.
So, sorry, some of our dear listeners might not be familiar exactly with Ilm al-Rijal. So what is the benefit of this field of study? I mean, for example, for fiqh, for ahkam, for akhlaq, there are some benefits. What benefits can you enumerate for Ilm al-Rijal?
You know, we have a hadith in the books, and we want to drive out the teachings of Islam from these ahadith, for example, fiqh, akhlaq, whatever it is, beliefs. And when we want to rely on these ahadith, we should accept that this hadith is narrated and is quoted from Imam alayhi salam, from one of the ma'sumin alayhi salatu wa salam. And because we are, ourselves are not the ones who have heard this ahadith from ma'sumin alayhi salatu wa salam, but there is a chain of narrators here. For example, nowadays, at least we have something like 10, 11, or 14, you know, people in the chain of narrators if a hadith wants to be transmitted to us. And the hadith that are narrated in the books of Sheikh al-Tusi and Sheikh al-Kulaini and Sheikh al-Mufid and the people like this, the number is something like 5, 6, or 7 people in the chain of narrators.
Okay.
So, okay, this hadith is narrated by these people in the chain of narrators, but how we may trust them?
Mm-hmm. How are they reliable?
Yeah.
Yes.
This is the place that Ilm al-Rijal is coming to the field, to the scene, and is helping and assisting us to know, okay, who is reliable, who is not reliable, who is lying, who is telling the truth, who are the figures who were close to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam, who were the people who were having a good memory in their life, who were the people who were having, wrong beliefs and, you know, corruption in their life, mm-hmm. and who were the people who were pious in their life. That's and right. All these, you know, issues are recorded in science and in a knowledge that is named Ilm al-Rijal.
That's right.
So this science and this, you know, knowledge is the one that is assisting us to get benefit from the legacy of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And if we were deprived from mm-hmm. this, you know, knowledge, mm-hmm. then we couldn't get benefit from this sea of ma'rifah and mm-hmm. sea of wisdom.
And we have this type of knowledge in both our Sunni brethren and Shia
yes,
brethren.
Yes.
Okay, Sheikh Mahtawi, he has also established some centers or, it's better to say, institutes for the Islamic Hausa studies and the Islamic studies and Shia studies. What are they exactly?
Okay, as you mentioned, he has established so many centers, among which we may name the Madrasa Fiqhiya Imam Baqir, which is the school, actually a jurisprudential school of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, which is in charge of nurturing and cultivating great students. Because after 10 years, I mean, this first period of time of studying in Hausa, students of seminary schools are entering the second level, which requires more knowledge, more talent, great asatid and masters. And it is a bit difficult to find a center in which you have access to the great scholars in different field of studies. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned in our discussion today, we talked about Ilm al-Rijal.
Yes.
And our listeners, they are familiar with the field of study of fiqh, which is jurisprudence, yes. and also usul al-fiqh. So it might be regarded as a difficult task for the students of seminary school to find all teachers from all these field of studies all together in one center, mm-hmm. in an organized process in which you start from the beginning, and after a while, you can master all these topics. So, alhamdulillah, as the moment it was established, in 1380, almost 20 years ago, the seminary of Qum in general is witnessing the fruit of these centers, okay. specifically the Madrasa Fiqhiya Imam Baqir. Nowadays, we see the great students that now they are standing at the position of the great scholars. That's by right. the benefit or by the blessing of participating in this school. That I think this is one of the brilliant point in his field of activities. And if we have time, I can mention other experience or one other memory from, we may call it the mixture of benefiting from the knowledge in defense of the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt. As we might see nowadays, there are so many attacks against our heritage and legacy. You might see one scholar, or you may call him so-called scholar, he come up talking against our legacy as a hadith, or different things that we have, du'as, du'a kumail, du'a nudda, ziyara, ashura, all these things that we have. You might read here and there so many attacks against these legacies that we have. Some years ago, we had a common attack against the Ziyarat Ashura, which is considered as one of the
most sacred
main, one of the main ziyara for the actually infallible imams, specifically for Imam Hussein. So this Ziyarat Ashura has got its position among all ziyarat that we have. So we had this argument against Ziyarat Ashura that it has been narrated through a weak chain of the narrators, so it is not reliable, or at least some parts of it must be omitted. We should not recite it. Why? Because we are not sure whether or not it has been narrated through fully authenticated chain of hadith. So we see at that position, the stance was taken by Ayatollah Shubayri Zanjani in a very long discussion. Very interestingly, he started his discussion with saying that besides having all those spiritual confirmation for this and spiritual approval for Ziyarat Ashura, you may say generally speaking, we have a lot of approvals and confirmation for Ziyarat Ashura, but technically, let me respond you. And technically, he addressed the issue saying that the Ziyarat Ashura is mentioned in the book of Al-Misbah al-Mujtahid written by Sheikh Tusi, and this is the chain of the narrators, that's starting with Muhammad ibn Khalid al-Tayalisi and going through the Saif ibn Umayrah, that I'm thinking it's going to be a bit technical for our listeners. By the way, I'm just trying to make this point that even though there are attacks against our legacies, but there are men, I mean great outstanding men, scholars in Hausa who defended from these, and Ayatollah Shubayri Zanjani is considered one of them. So we shouldn't be scared and afraid. If we feel somewhere someone is attacking, we have to go to his, I mean we have to go to the people who's got this speciality to answer and defend. That's and we see what he has done in his article, technically responding to that challenge against the reliability of Ziyarat Ashura.
Very good, very great. That's all right. And this is really the task of the, we can say, the men of narrations. I mean, the scholars who work in this field, including Sayyid Musa Shubayri Zanjani. Thank you, Sheikh Mahtavi.
Most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziya Inia, for your presence in the program. The teacher talking about the life account of Sayyid Musa Shubayri Zanjani. May Allah prolong his life, inshallah. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.